Hello, I'm Kirsty Young, and this is a podcast from the Desert Island Discs archive. For rights reasons, we've had to shorten the music. The programme was originally broadcast in 1978, and the presenter was Roy Plumley.
This week, our castaway is the playwright Tennessee Williams. Let's have the first record you've chosen, Mr. Williams.
The first one is a song I always request of a person with a great tenor voice. It's called Oh Danny Boy.
And who's the person with a great tenor voice on this occasion?
It's Harry Belafonte.
Oh Danny Boy, the pipes are calling from glen to glen and down the mountain side.
Harry Belafonte singing Danny Boy. Why did you choose that?
I don't know. It's so lyrical. It breaks my heart.
Does music play a big part in your life?
I love to hear it while I'm writing. You know, it affects the mood of the writing. I don't listen to it consciously, but it does seep into my consciousness as well.
It sort of takes up the slack and helps you to concentrate.
Yes.
Now, like many people, your first writing was poetry. Do you still think of yourself as a poet?
I find I do my best poetry within the context of a play. But I still write poems, yes.
You were born in Columbus, Mississippi. When you were about 12, you moved from the South to the Midwest.
When I was 8, actually.
When you were 8. What was your reaction to that?
As if entering a nightmare. Because I lived under the gentle influence of my grandparents in Mississippi, and I was suddenly transported to the crudity and brutality of St. Louis, where we were suddenly conscious that we were poor.
Did you do a great deal of reading, all sorts of reading?
There was a year in my life, I think it was between 7 and 8, when I was confined to the bed most of the time with either rheumatic fever or diphtheria. The country doctors of that time were not too precise about one's maladies.
Which writers influenced you most as a youngster?
I read all of Chekhov at the age of 10. All of Shakespeare, I beg your pardon, Shakespeare by the age
Shakespeare
of 10.
Shakespeare first?
Then yeah. Chekhov became my greatest influence later on.
And then you began to express yourself by your own writing, so much that you flunked at the University of Missouri. I mean, you were too busy sort of writing your own.
I fell in love with a girl named Ella Jean O'Donnell, and I didn't give a damn about anything else.
So as a result, when you came out of university, you had to go work in industry.
Yeah, my father said, I'm not going to keep him in school if he makes grades like this. Also, I'd flunked ROTC, which particularly offended him. Mm-hmm. Military training.
Yes, we have it too. So you had to go to work in a shoe company.
Yes, for 3 years.
Doing what?
I did all of the most onerous tasks that could be imagined by the boss. He couldn't fire me because my father had gotten him his job. You see, the International Shoe Company is composed of many branches, and my father was in one, and he had gotten this man his job in another. So the man felt he couldn't fire me, but he wanted me to quit. So he gave me all these terrible jobs, like dusting off 1,000 or so samples of shoes, you know, and carrying huge sample cases across town.
Had you started writing plays?
No. I did my first play immediately after that.
Yes.
In Memphis, Tennessee.
Why plays? Had you seen a lot of theater as a youngster?
No, I hadn't seen. There wasn't much theatre in St. Louis. The first time I saw a play that deeply, deeply moved me was Ghosts, Ibsen's Ghosts with Alan Azimova.
Yeah.
It moved me to the extent that it moved me right out of my seat, and I just couldn't sit still. I had to pace up and down the back aisle, the peanut gallery.
Now, after that 3 years in the shoe industry, you decided that education really was important. You put yourself back into college.
My grandmother did.
With your approval?
Oh, indeed, yes. I wanted to complete my education.
And having done that, you spent a few years roaming around the country.
Oh, quite a few, yes. I remember running into the back end of a cow on a bicycle. The bicycle was demolished, but the cow didn't seem to mind.
And writing while you roamed. There was a time when you went overnight from a $17 a week job as a cinema usher to $250 a week on the MGM payroll.
That's rather funny, yeah. At that time, I had a lovely lady agent named Audrey Wood, and I was working at the Strand Theater on Broadway, movie house. They were showing Casablanca, incidentally. And one day, she called me into her office, and she said, Tennessee, I've got a job for you in Hollywood that pays $250. I said, $250 a month. I thought that was a huge sum. And she said, you misunderstand me. It's $250 a week.
Now tell me about working for MGM. You were in Writer's Row?
Yes, I had a very lovely office. I was put on an impossible assignment, writing for Lana Turner, who happened to have caught the fancy of the producer, you know.
And did you find that difficult to write for her?
Well, yes, it presented some difficulties because he knew her limits of vocabulary, and he said, I'm afraid these lines, beautiful as they are not quite within her range. And then he offered me a job of writing for Child Star. Now, I never liked Child Star, but I regret to say that.
You and W.C. Fields both.
Yeah.
So you didn't really make a great success at MGM.
No, they didn't renew my option, but I saved up quite a bit of money. I lived very frugally, but pleasantly.
Let's have another record. What shall we have next?
Oh, That We Two Were Maying. Yes, that's one of my childhood days' favorite. You know, it was one of my mother's favorites, my grandmother's. It's a duet by a contralto and a mezzo-soprano, I believe.
Oh, That We Two Were Maying, Opus 2, Number 8, by Nevin, it says here, sung by Alma Gluck and Louise Homer. I'm sorry to say that it was in MGM's time that you wrote the first play that brought you recognition.
Oh, I've been working on that play before, and I've worked on it after, and I never submitted it to MGM. That's just I don't know who invented that story.
That was the Battle of
the
Angels.
The Glass Menagerie.
Glass Menagerie, was it?
Yeah. I'd already done Battle of Angels.
Yes.
Which closed disastrously out of town.
It closed in Boston, I believe.
In Boston, yeah.
So that meant back to routine jobs for several years more.
Indeed, yes.
And then The Glass Menagerie, that was your first play on Broadway.
It was the first hit that I had, and I gave half of it to my mother, the money, I mean, because it was based entirely upon her personality. The other characters were not so closely. Eliminated my father altogether.
A very slight, tender, nostalgic play.
Yes.
And a great deal in it of your sister Rose.
Well, my sister Rose had a little more spirit than Laura Wakefield exposed.
Your empathy with your sister must have been very strong, because there was a sad period in her young life when she became demented. And your next two successful plays, A Streetcar Named Desire and Summer and Smoke, were both about young Southern ladies going through a disturbed patch.
Yes, well, my sister developed schizophrenia in her middle 20s, after a long period of badly diagnosed psychosomatic disorders. They were going to perform an exploratory operation on her to find out why she couldn't eat, and then finally the family doctor said, "Mrs. Williams, the trouble is that you are so puritanical, and your sister is not a Dakin, but a Williams, and she's very highly sexed. I think if she's not got a fiancé, that could be an arranged marriage." My mother screamed like a banshee.
Well, A Streetcar, of course, was a breakthrough, probably the most down-to-earth and realistic play to have appeared on the American stage. Did you guess it was going to become a worldwide success?
I thought it was going to be a terrible flop.
Magnificent performance by the young Marlon Brando, and the original girl was...
Jessica Tandy.
Jessica Tandy.
An English lady.
Now, your successful plays have, as a matter of course, been made into film versions. Have you worked on the screenplays yourself?
On several of them, yes. I worked on Orpheus Descending. I wrote that for Anna Magnani. I wrote The Rose Tattoo for Anna Magnani. And I did a little work on The Roman Spring of Mrs. Stone, which was written by Gavin Lambert. The screenplay was written by Gavin Lambert. I'd just written the novel. But I wrote one or two scenes, he says.
Right. Your third record, what's that?
Oh, that's The Beatles. I heard the news today. Oh, boy.
Why did you choose that?
Because I've always loved The Beatles, and I was very sad when they broke up. I thought they had the most beautiful diction, and the lyrics were important lyrics. You know, they said something interesting.
I read the news today, oh boy, about a lucky man who made the grade. And though the news was rather sad, I just had to laugh. I saw the photograph.
A Day in the Life by the Beatles. Now, lists are boring things, but let's recite the titles of just one or two more of your successes. The Rose Tattoo, Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, The Night of the Iguana. A very impressive and long list. You admit to being a compulsive writer. You're not really happy unless you're writing. Is that true?
I feel very, very guilty if a day passes in which I haven't written.
Are you disciplined in the hours that you write? Do you like to start at a regular time every day?
I like to start immediately when I wake up.
In the 60s, you had a very bad patch, or a bad breakdown. Did you find writing a kind of therapy, or at that time was it something?
Writing was the one therapy. And strangely, people don't recognize that I made some of my most daring departures in writing during that period. Plays like In the Bar of a Tokyo Hotel.
Which we haven't seen over yet.
No. The Gnadiges Fräulein.
Another we haven't seen.
Yeah, it was part of a double bill called Slapstick Tragedy. Kingdom of Earth you have seen in England and the provinces, mm-hmm. successfully too.
And now you brought a new play to London, Vieux Carré. This is an autobiographical piece. The Vieux Carré, of course, is the old French quarter of New Orleans. And this was your youthful days in a rooming house.
This was my entrance into that state called Bohemia.
Yes. A state of which you're still a citizen.
Yes, but I maintain a precarious balance between citizenship in Bohemia and in the world of propriety.
Oh, that's nice.
I tried to.
And you still have two or three recent plays as yet unproduced.
Oh, yes, three, yeah.
Three.
Usually that sounds corny, but it happens to be true, because if you work every day, it happens.
Record number four.
While I was riding Streetcar, just around the corner, there was a bar called Victor's. And after work, I would go to Victor's to fortify myself with a Brandy Alexander. Mm. And they had this Ink Spots record on the jukebox, and I would always play that while drinking the Brandy Alexander.
In which city was this?
New Orleans.
Every prayer begin and end with just your name. And would I be sure that this is long beyond compare? Would all this be true if I didn't care for you?
The Ink Spot. In recent years, you've been acting yourself in Small Craft Warning. Was that a long-cherished ambition? Had you done any acting before?
Appallingly, in college, at the University of Iowa, I was given non-speaking parts because I would just have a vocal freeze, you know, I couldn't get the lines out, but they allowed me to appear. And in one part I had one line. I get so nervous that by the time I came to that line, which is so-and-so is at the gate, my lord, or something like that, I could hardly say it intelligibly, and the whole house would come down with laughter.
But now you got over that, and you did indeed play a leading part.
Played the part of an old doctor who'd lost his license through drunkenness. Smoker's Warning, yeah.
Did you write the part with yourself in mind? I mean, did you think this would be a vehicle?
Not at all. I was forced into, and during the summer months, you know, Theatre Falls in New York, and I was told that I could, by taking over that part, I could build up attendance, which I did indeed do, and we got through nearly 6 months.
Are you going to do it again?
I'm going to play the part of Sorin. That's the invalid old brother, Madame McCardina, in The Seagull, you know?
Yes.
He doesn't have to say too much. He just complains.
Where and when are you going to do that?
Whenever I finish my adaptation of The Seagull, which has never been, to my mind, properly translated.
Another record.
Another record is Elvis Presley's Love Me Tender. I happened to meet Elvis Presley when I took my mother out to Hollywood on a vacation. He was particularly sweet to her. And she said, "Oh, what a charming young man." Well, he looked pretty good that time and showed no sign of dissipation.
Love me tender, love me sweet, never let me go. You have made my life complete, and
Elvis Presley, Love Me Tender. Now, your plays have obviously given you financial independence. You like to travel the world. You had, in fact, made your first visit to Europe when you were about 16.
17.
How did that come about?
My grandfather conducted a tour of Episcopal ladies through Europe.
How many of them?
Oh, countless, countless.
Yes, yes. Your father...
All mad at each other and tripping each other up in hotel, in railway corridors, that sort of thing, you know. It was too laughable for words.
Your grandfather was a parson.
Episcopal minister, yes. Yeah, parson, you might say, yeah. They call him preacher. In Mississippi. He was a dearly loved man, a man of great sweetness.
And you came to London?
We came to London, and I remember eating in a restaurant that had been patronized by Charles Dickens.
Now, you've known the London Theatre pretty intimately for getting on for 30 years. Yeah. What do you think of the state of our theatre now?
It's certainly preferable to the New York state of theatre.
You think?
In my opinion, yes, because you have Harold Pinter, who is... the greatest of all contemporary playwrights, in my opinion. And your actors cannot be equaled in America, hardly.
Let's move on to your sixth record.
It's also a record I associate with New Orleans, right across from my rental apartments, one of which I occupy occasionally. There was a bar called the Chopping Block, and on their jukebox, they had this enchanting record called The Shadow of a Smile, sung by Miss Vaughan.
Sarah Vaughan, The Shadow of Your Smile. Now, we've dumped you on this sad desert island, Tennessee. How will you stand up to loneliness? Could you endure it?
If I had a typewriter and plenty of typing paper, yeah.
Right, then that's your luxury, because I was going to give you one luxury on the island. Yeah. The compulsive writer, always.
Yes,
on the practical side, could you look after yourself? Could you build somewhere to live?
That I'm uncertain about. It would have to be, you know, fairly deep in the tropics where I wouldn't freeze to death.
Yes, we'll see.
I should like to be able to swim, you know.
And you could forage for food and fish?
If there were any, I once called a sailfish, but I was glad when it got away.
Would you try to escape?
Oh, yes. They'd run out of typing paper eventually, wouldn't they?
We'll see you have enough. We've got to your last record, but one. What's that going to be?
Quiereme mucho, which means love me much. I used to hear it continually in Cuba before the days of Castro. Key West, where I live, is only 45 minutes from Cuba, and I used to go over, and I would always request the hotel band to play Quiereme mucho. Sometimes they would start playing it as soon as they saw me out of the bar.
And who sings it?
It's sung here by Tito Skipa, I never heard anybody that grand sing it, but he sings it well, I believe.
Cuando se quiere de veras, como te quiere.
Quiereme mucho, sung by Tito Skipa, which brings us now to your last record.
My last record is Judy Garland. I adored Judy Garland, as did everybody, I believe, who knew her.
And what does she sing?
Me and My Shadow.
'Cause nobody's there, just me. Shadow, all alone and
Me and My Shadow by Judy Garland. If you could take just one disc out of the eight that you played us, which would it be?
It's hard to choose between Danny Boy and Me and My Shadow by Judy. It's hard to choose.
Right, a snap decision, which?
Probably Danny Boy.
Danny Boy by Harry Belafonte. Now, you've chosen your one luxury. That's your typewriter and as much paper as you're likely to need. One book, apart from the Bible and Shakespeare, which are already on the island, and we don't allow big encyclopedias. What are you going to choose?
The Collected Poems of the American Poet Hart Crane.
The Collected Poems of Hart Crane. And thank you, Tennessee Williams, for letting us hear your Desert Island Disc.
Thank you so very much. I enjoyed every minute.
Goodbye, everyone.
You've been listening to a podcast from the Desert Island Discs archive. For more podcasts, please visit bbc.co.uk/radio4.